This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Calypso, written by David Sedaris and read by the author.
For Joan Lacey. Company man. Though there's an industry built on telling you otherwise, there are few real joys to middle age. The only perk I can see is that with luck, you'll acquire a guest room. Some people get one by default when their kids leave home, and others, like me, eventually trade up and land a bigger house. Follow me, I now say. The room I lead our visitors to has not been hastily rearranged to accommodate them. It does not double as an office or weaving nook, but exists for only one purpose. I have furnished it with a bed rather than a fold-out sofa, and against one wall, just like in a hotel, I've placed a luggage rack. The best feature, though, is its private bathroom. If you prefer a shower to a tub, I can put you upstairs in the second guest room, I say. There's a luggage rack up there as well. I hear these words coming from my puppet-lined mouth and shiver with middle-aged satisfaction. Yes, my hair is gray and thinning. Yes, the washer on my penis has worn out, leaving me to dribble urine long after I've zipped my trousers back up. But I have two guest rooms. The consequence is that if you live in Europe, they attract guests, lots of them. People spend a fortune on their plane tickets from the United States. By the time they arrive, they're broke and tired and would probably sleep in our car if we offered it. In Normandy, where we used to have a country place, any visitors were put up in the attic, which doubled as Hugh's studio and smelled of oil paint and decaying mice. It had a rustic cathedral ceiling but no heat, meaning it was usually either too cold or too hot. That house had only one bathroom, wedged between the kitchen and our bedroom. Guests were denied the privacy a person sometimes needs on the toilet, so twice a day I'd take Hugh to the front door and shout behind us, as if this were normal behavior, "We're going out for exactly 20 minutes. Does anyone need anything from the side of the road?" That was another problem with Normandy. There was nothing for our company to do except sit around. Our village had no businesses in it, and the walk to the nearest village that did was not terribly pleasant. This is not to say that our visitors didn't enjoy themselves, just that it took a certain kind of person, outdoorsy and self-motivating. In West Sussex, where we currently live, having company is a bit easier. Within a 10-mile radius of our house, there's a quaint little town with a castle in it, and an equally charming one with 37 antique stores. There are chalk-speckled hills one can hike up, and bike trails. It's a 15-minute drive to the beach and an easy walk to the nearest pub. Guests usually take the train from London, and before we pick them up at the station, I remind Hugh that for the duration of their visit, he and I will be playing the role of a perfect couple. This means no bickering and no contradicting each other. If I am seated at the kitchen table and he is standing behind me, he is to place a hand on my shoulder, right on the spot where a parrot would perch if I were a pirate instead of the ideal boyfriend. When I tell a story he has heard so often he could lip-sync it, he is to pretend to be hearing it for the first time and to be appreciating it as much or more than our guests are. I'm to do the same and to feign delight when he serves something I hate, like fish with little bones in it. I really blew this a few years back when his friend Sue came for the night and he poached what might as well have been a hairbrush. Blew it to such an extent that after she left, I considered having her killed. "She knows too much," I said to Hugh. "The woman's a liability now, and we need to contain her." His friend Jane saw some ugliness as well. And though I like both her and Sue, and have known them for going on 20 years, they fall under the category of Hugh's guests. This means that though I play my role, it is not my responsibility to entertain them. Yes, I offer the occasional drink. I show up for meals, but can otherwise come and go at my leisure, exiting sometimes as someone is in the middle of a sentence. My father has done this all his life. You'll be talking to him and he'll walk away, not angry, but just sort of finished with you. I was probably 6 years old the first time I noticed this. You'd think I'd have found it hurtful, but instead I looked at his retreating back thinking, we can get away with that? Really? Yippee! 3 of my sisters visited us in Sussex the Christmas of 2012, so Gretchen and Amy took a guest room each. Hugh and I gave Lisa the master bedroom and moved next door to the converted stable I use as my office. One of the things he noted during their stay was that, with the exception of Amy and me, no one in my family ever says good night. Rather, they just leave the room, sometimes halfway through dinner, and reappear the following morning. My sisters were considered my guests, but because there was a group of them, and they could easily entertain one another, I was more or less free to go about my business, not that I didn't spend time with them. In various pairings, we went on walks and bike rides, but otherwise they sat in the living room talking or gathered in the kitchen to study Hugh at the stove. I joined them for a while and then explained that I had some work to do. This meant going next door to the stable where I'd switch on my computer and turn to Google thinking, I wonder what Russell Crowe is up to. One of the reasons I'd invited these three over, had gone so far as to buy their tickets, was that this felt like a last hurrah. Except for Paul, who has no passport but tells me with great certainty that according to an electrician he met on a job site, it is possible to buy one at the airport, we are all in our 50s now. Health-wise, we've been fortunate, but it's just a matter of time before our luck runs out and one of us gets cancer. Then we'll be picked off like figures at a shooting gallery. Easy targets, given the lives we've led. I counted the days until my sister's arrival, so why wasn't I next door, sitting with Hugh in our perfect couple 16th-century kitchen with its stone floor and crackling fire? Perhaps I worried that if I didn't wander off, my family would get on my nerves, or, far more likely, I would get on theirs, and that our week together wouldn't be as ideal as I told myself it would be. As it was, I'd retreat to my office and spend some time doing nothing of consequence. Then I'd head back into the house and hear something that made me wish I'd never left. It was like walking into a theater an hour after the picture has started, thinking, how did that kangaroo get his hands on those nunchucks? One of the stories I entered late concerned some pills my sister Gretchen had started taking a year and a half earlier. She didn't say what they were prescribed for, but they were causing her to walk and eat in her sleep. I saw this happen the previous Thanksgiving, which we spent together in a rental house in Hawaii. Dinner was served at 7 o'clock, and around midnight, an hour or so after she'd gone to bed, Gretchen drifted out of her room. Hugh and I looked up from our books and watched her enter the kitchen. There, she took the turkey out of the refrigerator and started twisting off meat with her fingers. Why don't you get a plate? I asked, and she looked at me, not scornfully, but blankly, as if it had been the wind talking. Then she reached into the carcass and yanked out some stuffing. This was picked at selectively, one crouton mysteriously favored over another, until she decided she'd had enough, at which point she returned to her room, leaving the mess behind her. What was that about? I asked her the next morning. Gretchen's face adjusted itself for bad news. What was what about? I told her what had happened, and she said, God damn it! I wondered why I woke up with brown stains on my pillow. According to the story I walked in on late, Thanksgiving had been a relatively good night for Gretchen. One morning, a few weeks after the turkey episode, she walked into her kitchen in North Carolina and found on the countertop an open jam jar with crumbs in it. First she thought they were from a cookie. Then she saw the overturned box and realized she had eaten something intended for her painted turtles. It was a nutrition bar, maybe 4 inches long, and made of dead flies, pressed together the way Duraflame logs are. Not only that, she said, but when I was through, I ate all the petals off my poinsettia. She shook her head. I noticed it on the counter next to the turtle food box, and it was just a naked stalk. I returned to my office more convinced than ever that this would be our last Christmas together. I mean, flies. If you're going to eat your pet's food in your sleep, why not think preventatively and exchange your turtles for a hamster or a rabbit, something safe and vegetarian? Get rid of the houseplants while you're at it, starting with the cactus, and lock up your cleaning supplies. Later that evening, I found the sisters stretched out like cats in front of the wood stove. It used to be that whenever I passed a mirror, I'd look at my face, Gretchen said, blowing out a mouthful of cigarette smoke. Now I just check to see if my nipples line up. Oh my God, I thought, when did that start happening? The last time we were all together for Christmas was 1994. We were at Gretchen's house in Raleigh, and she started the day by feeding her bullfrog, who was around the same size as her iron and was named Pappy. He was kept in a murky, heated, 30-gallon aquarium on her living room floor next to three Japanese newts who lived in a meatloaf pan. It was a far cry from a normal Christmas, but what with our mother recently dead, it seemed better to break with tradition and try something completely different. Thus, my sister's place, with its feel of a swamp, rather than the house we had grown up in, which now felt freighted with too much history. Gretchen's waist-length hair has gone silver since that Christmas, and when she walks in her sleep, she limps a little. But then, we're all getting older. On our first day together in Sussex, we piled into the Volvo and rode to the town with the 37 antique stores. Hugh drove, and I crawled into the way back, thinking, happily, here we are again, me and my sisters in a station wagon, just like when we were young. Who would have imagined in 1966 that we'd one day be riding through southern England, none of us having realized the futures we'd predicted for ourselves? Amy was not the policewoman she'd so hoped to become. Lisa was not a nurse. No one had a house full of servants or a trained proboscis monkey. Yet we'd turned out okay, hadn't we? In one of the antique stores we visited that afternoon, we saw a barrister's wig. It was foul, all the colors of dirty underpants, but that didn't stop Amy and then Gretchen from trying it on. That's okay, Lisa said when it was handed to her. I don't want to get y'all's germs on my head. They're germs, I thought. The sun set at around 4 that afternoon, and it was dark by the time we headed home. I fell asleep in the way back for a few minutes, and when I awoke, Lisa was discussing her uterus, specifically her fear that its lining may have grown too thick. What on earth gives you that idea? Amy asked. Lisa then mentioned a friend of hers, saying that if it could happen to Cynthia, it could just as easily happen to her, or to any of us, she said. And what if it does? Gretchen asked. Then we'll have to get them scraped out, Lisa reported. I lifted my head over the back seat. What's a uterus lined with anyway? I imagined something sweet and viscous, like whatever it is that grapes are made of. That would be grape, Amy said. Grapes are made of grape. Actually, it's a good question, Lisa said. What is a uterus lined with? Blood vessels? Nerves? Your family, Hugh said. I can't believe the things you talk about when you're together. I later reminded him of the time his sister Anne visited us in Normandy. I walked into the living room after returning from a bike ride one afternoon and heard her saying to her mother, Joan, who was also staying with us, "Don't you just love the feel of an iguana?" "Who are you people?" I remember thinking. That same night, after my bath, I overheard her asking, "Well, can't you make it with camel butter?" "You can," Mrs. Hamrick said, "but I wouldn't recommend it." I thought of asking for details. Make what with camel butter? But decided I preferred the mystery. That often happens with company. I'll forever wonder what a guest from Paris meant when I walked into the yard one evening and heard her saying, "Mini goats might be nice." Or odder still, when Hugh's father, Sam, came to visit with an old friend he'd known from the State Department. The two had been discussing the time they'd spent in Cameroon in the late 60s, and I entered the kitchen to hear Mr. Hamrick say, "Now, was that guy a pygmy? Or just a false pygmy?" I turned around and headed to my office thinking, I'll ask later. Then Hugh's father died, as did his old friend from the State Department. I suppose I could Google false pygmy, but it wouldn't be the same. I had my chance to find out what one was, and I blew it. One of Hugh's greatest regrets is that his father never saw the house in Sussex. It's the kind of place that was right up Sam's alley, a ruin transformed in such a way that it still looks pretty beat up. The main difference is that now the wiring is safe, and there's heat. Mrs. Hamrick visits, though, and sometimes she and Hugh will sit in the kitchen and talk about Sam. It's not the snippets of conversation that betray him as the subject, but rather their voices, which, almost a decade after his death, are still brittle and reverential, full of loss and longing. It's how my sisters and I used to be when talking about our mother. Now, though, after 27 years, almost every discussion of her ends with the line, "And can you believe she was so young?" Soon we'll be the age she was when she got cancer and was killed by it. Then we'll be even older, which just seems wrong. Against nature, somehow. I made up my mind eons ago that I would not let that happen, that I would also die at 62. Then I hit my mid-50s and started thinking that perhaps I'm being a bit harsh. Now that I've scored a couple of decent guest rooms, it seems silly not to get a little more use out of them. When visitors leave, I feel like an actor watching the audience file out of the theater, and it was no different with my sisters. The show over, Hugh and I return to lesser versions of ourselves. We're not a horrible couple, but we have our share of fights, the type that can start with a misplaced sock and suddenly be about everything. "I haven't liked you since 2002, he hissed during a recent argument over which airport security line was moving the fastest. This didn't hurt me so much as confuse me. "What happened in 2002? I asked. On the plane, he apologized, and a few weeks later, when I brought it up over dinner, he claimed to have no memory of it. That's one of Hugh's many outstanding qualities. He doesn't hold on to things. Another is that he's very good to old people, a group that in the not-too-distant future will include me. It's just this damned middle-age period I have to get through. The secret, of course, is to stay busy. So when the company leaves, I clean their bathrooms and strip their beds. If the guests were mine, my sisters, for example, I'll sit on the edge of the mattress and hold their sheets to my chest, hugging them a moment and breathing in their smell, before standing back up and making my rickety way to that laundry room I always wanted. Now we are 5. In late May 2013, a few weeks shy of her 50th birthday, my youngest sister, Tiffany, committed suicide. She was living in a room in a beat-up house on the hard end of Somerville, Massachusetts, and had been dead, the coroner guessed, for at least 5 days before her door was battered down. I was given the news over a white courtesy phone while at the Dallas airport. Then, because my plane to Baton Rouge was boarding and I wasn't sure what else to do, I got on it. The following morning, I boarded another plane, this one to Atlanta, and the day after that I flew to Nashville, thinking all the while about my ever-shrinking family. A person expects his parents to die, but a sibling? I felt I'd lost the identity I'd enjoyed since 1968 when my brother was born. 6 kids, people would say. How do your poor folks manage? There were a lot of big families in the neighborhood I grew up in. Every other house was a fiefdom, so I never gave it much thought, until I became an adult and my friends started having children. One or two seemed reasonable, but anything beyond that struck me as outrageous. A couple Hugh and I knew in Normandy would occasionally come to dinner with their wrecking crew of 3, and when they'd leave several hours later, every last part of me would feel violated. Take those kids, double them, and subtract the cable TV. That's what my parents had to deal with. Now, though, there weren't 6, only 5. And you can't really say there used to be six, I told my sister Lisa. It just makes people uncomfortable. I recalled a father and son I'd met in California a few years back. So are there other children? I asked. There are, the man said. Three who are living, and a daughter, Chloe, who died before she was born 18 years ago. That's not fair, I remember thinking, because, I mean, what's a person supposed to do with that? Compared to most 49-year-olds, or even most 49-month-olds, Tiffany didn't have much. She did leave a will, though. In it, she decreed that we, her family, could not have her body or attend her memorial service. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, our mother would have said. A few days after getting the news, my sister Amy drove to Somerville with a friend and collected two boxes of things from Tiffany's room, family photos, many of which had been ripped into pieces, comment cards from a neighborhood grocery store, notebooks, receipts. The bed, a mattress on the floor, had been taken away, and a large industrial fan had been set up. Amy snapped some pictures while she was there, and individually and in groups, those of us left studied them for clues. A paper plate on a dresser that had several drawers missing. A phone number written on a wall. A collection of mop handles, each one a different color, arranged like cattails in a barrel painted green. 6 months before our sister killed herself, I had made plans for us all to gather at a beach house on Emerald Isle, off the coast of North Carolina. My family used to vacation there every summer, but after my mother died, we stopped going. Not because we lost interest, but because it was she who always made the arrangements and, more important, paid for it. The place I found with the help of my sister-in-law, Kathy, had 6 bedrooms and a small swimming pool. Our week-long rental period began on Saturday, June 8th, and we arrived to find that a livery woman standing in the driveway with 7 pounds of seafood, a sympathy gift sent by friends. "They slum there, too," she said, handing over the bags. In the past, when my family rented a cottage, my sisters and I would crowd the door like puppies around a food dish. Our father would unlock it, and we'd tear through the house claiming rooms. I always picked the biggest one facing the ocean, and just as I'd start to unpack, my parents would enter and tell me that this was theirs. "I mean, just who the hell do you think you are?" my father would ask. He and my mother would move in, and I would get booted to what was called the maid's room. It was always on the ground level, a kind of dank shed next to where the car was parked. There was never an interior stairway leading to the upper floor. Instead, I had to take the outside steps and, more often than not, knock on the locked front door like a beggar, hoping to be invited in. "What do you want?" my sisters would ask. "I want to come inside." "That's funny," Lisa, the eldest, would say to the others who were gathered like disciples around her. "Did you hear something? A whining sound? What is it that makes a noise like that? A hermit crab? A little sea slug?" Normally there was a social divide between the 3 oldest and the 3 youngest children in my family. Lisa, Gretchen, and I treated the others like servants and did very well for ourselves. At the beach, though, all bets were off, and it was just upstairs against downstairs, meaning everyone against me. This time, because I was paying, I got to choose the best room. Amy moved in next door, and my brother Paul, his wife, and their 10-year-old daughter, Maddie, took the spot next to her. That was it for Oceanfront. The others arrived later and had to take the leftovers. Lisa's room faced the street, as did my father's. Gretchen's room faced the street and was intended for someone who was paralyzed. Hanging from the ceiling were electric pulleys designed to lift a harnessed body into and out of bed. Unlike the cottages of our youth, this one did not have a maid's room. It was too new and fancy for that, as were the homes that surrounded it. Traditionally, the island houses were on stilts, but more and more often now, the ground floors are filled in. They all have beachy names and are painted beachy colors, but most of those built after Hurricane Fran hit the coast in 1996 are 3 stories tall and look almost suburban. This place was vast and airy. The kitchen table sat 12, and there was not one but two dishwashers. The pictures were ocean-related, seascapes and lighthouses, all with the airborne Vs that are shorthand for seagull. A sampler on the living room wall read, "Old Schellers never die. They simply conk out." On the round clock beside it, the numbers lay in an indecipherable heap, as if they'd come unglued. Just above them were printed the words, "Who cares?" This was what we found ourselves saying whenever anyone asked the time. Who cares? The day before we arrived at the beach, Tiffany's obituary ran in the Raleigh News and Observer. It was submitted by Gretchen, who stated that our sister had passed away peacefully at her home. This made it sound as if she were very old and had a house. But what else could you do? People were leaving responses on the paper's website, and one fellow wrote that Tiffany used to come into the video store where he worked in Somerville. When his glasses broke, she offered him a pair she had found while foraging for art supplies in somebody's trash can. He said she also gave him a Playboy magazine from the 1960s that included a photo spread titled "The Ass Menagerie." This was fascinating, as we really didn't know our sister very well. All of us had pulled away from the family at some point in our lives. We'd had to in order to forge our own identities, to go from being a Sedaris to our own specific Sedaris. Tiffany, though, stayed away. She might promise to come home for Christmas, but at the last minute there'd always be some excuse. She missed her plane, she had to work. The same would happen with our summer vacations. "The rest of us managed to make it," I'd say, aware of how old and guilt-trippy I sounded. We'd all be disappointed by her absence, though for different reasons. Even if you weren't getting along with Tiffany at the time, you couldn't deny the show she put on, the dramatic entrances, the nonstop professional-grade insults, the chaos she'd inevitably leave in her wake. One day she'd throw a dish at you, and the next she'd create a mosaic made of the shards. When allegiances with one brother or sister flamed out, she'd take up with someone else. At no time did she get along with everybody, but there was always someone she was in contact with. Toward the end, it was Lisa, but before that, we'd all had our turn. The last time she joined us on Emerald Isle was in 1986, and even then she left after 3 days, Gretchen reminded us. As kids, we spent our beach time swimming. Then we became teenagers and devoted ourselves to tanning. There's a certain kind of talk that takes place when you're lying, dazed in the sun, and I've always been partial to it. On the first afternoon of our most recent trip, we laid out on one of the bedspreads we'd had as children and arranged ourselves side by side on it, trading stories about Tiffany. "What about the Halloween she spent on that army base? And the time she showed up at Dad's birthday party with a black eye? I remember this girl she met years ago at a party," I began when my turn came. She'd been talking about facial scars and how terrible it would be to have one. So Tiffany said, "I have a little scar on my face, and I don't think it's so awful." "Well," the girl said, "you would if you were pretty." Amy laughed and rolled over onto her stomach. "Oh, that's a good line." I rearranged the towel I was using as a pillow. "Isn't it, though?" Coming from someone else, a story might have been upsetting, but not being pretty was never one of Tiffany's problems, especially when she was in her 20s and 30s and men tumbled helpless before her. "Funny," I said, "but I don't remember a scar on her face." I stayed in the sun too long that day and got a burn on my forehead. That was basically it for me in the beach blanket. I made brief appearances for the rest of the week, stopping to dry off after a swim, but mainly I spent my days on a bike, cycling up and down the coast and thinking about what had happened. While the rest of us seemed to get along effortlessly, with Tiffany, it always felt like work. She and I usually made up after arguing, but our last fight took it out of me, and at the time of her death, we hadn't spoken in 8 years. During that period, I regularly found myself near Somerville, and though I'd always toy with the idea of contacting her, I never did, despite my father's encouragement. Meanwhile, I'd get reports from him and Lisa. Tiffany had lost her apartment, had gone on disability, had moved into a room found for her by a social service agency. Perhaps she was more forthcoming with her friends, but her family got things only in bits and pieces. She didn't talk with us so much as at us, great blocks of speech that were by turns funny, astute, and so contradictory it was hard to connect the sentence you were hearing with the one that preceded it. Before we stopped speaking, I could always tell when she was on the phone. I'd walk into the house and hear Hugh say, In addition to the two boxes that Amy had filled in Somerville, she also brought down our sister's 1978 ninth grade yearbook. Among the messages inscribed by her classmates was the following, written by someone who had drawn a marijuana leaf beside her name. "Tiffany, you are a one-of-a-kind girl, so stay that way, you unique ass. I'm only sorry we couldn't have partied more together. This school sucks to hell. Stay cool, stoned, drunk, fucked up. Check your ass later." Then there's, "Tiffany, I'm looking forward to getting high with you this summer." And, "Tiffany, call me sometime this summer and we'll go out and get blitzed." A few weeks after these messages were written, Tiffany ran away and was subsequently sent to a disciplinary institution in Maine called Elan. According to what she told us later, it was a horrible place. She returned home in 1980, having spent 2 years there, and from that point on, none of us can recall a conversation in which she did not mention it. She blamed the family for sending her off, but we, her siblings, had nothing to do with it. Paul, for instance, was 10 when she left. I was 21. For a year, I sent her monthly letters. Then she wrote and told me to stop. As for my parents, there were only so many times they could apologize. "We had other kids," they said in their defense. "You think we could let the world stop on account of any one of you?" We were at the beach for 3 days before Lisa and our father, who is now 90, joined us. Being on the island meant missing the spinning classes he takes in Raleigh. So I found a fitness center not far from the rental cottage, and every afternoon he and I would spend some time there. On the way over, we talked to each other, but as soon as we mounted our stationary bikes, we'd each retreat into our own thoughts. It was a small place, not very lively. A mute television oversaw the room, tuned to the weather channel, and reminding us that there's always a catastrophe somewhere or other, always someone flooded from his home or running for his life from a funnel-shaped cloud. Toward the end of the week, I came upon my father in Amy's room, sifting through the photos that Tiffany had destroyed. In his hand was a fragment of my mother's head with a patch of blue sky behind her. Under what circumstances had this been ripped up, I wondered. It seemed like such a melodramatic gesture, like throwing a glass against a wall, something someone in a movie would do. "Just awful," my father whispered. "A person's life reduced to one lousy box." I put my hand on his shoulder. "Actually, there are two of them," he corrected himself. "Two lousy boxes." One afternoon on Emerald Isle, we all rode to the Food Lion for groceries. I was in the produce department, looking at red onions, when my brother sneaked up from behind and let loose with a loud "Achoo!" This while whipping a bouquet of wet parsley through the air. I felt the spray on the back of my neck and froze, thinking a very sick stranger had just sneezed on me. It's a neat trick, but he also doused the Indian woman, who was standing to my left. She was wearing a blood-colored sari, so got it on her bare arm, as well as her neck and the lower part of her back. "Sorry, man," Paul said when she turned around, horrified. "I was just playing a joke on my brother." The woman had many thin bracelets on, and they jangled as she brushed her hand against the back of her head. "You called her man," I said to him after she walked off. "For real?" he asked. Amy mimicked him perfectly. "For real?" Over the phone, my brother, like me, is often mistaken for a woman. As we continued shopping, he told me that his van had recently broken down, and that when he called for a tow truck, the dispatcher said, "We'll be right out, sweetie," He lowered a watermelon into the cart and turned to his daughter. Maddie's got a daddy who talks like a lady, but she don't care, do she? Giggling, she punched him in the stomach, and I was struck by how comfortable the two of them are with each other. Our father was a figure of authority, while Paul is more of a playmate. When we went to the beach as children, on or about the fourth day, our father would say, "Wouldn't it be nice to buy a cottage down here?" We'd get our hopes up, and then he would bring practical concerns into it. They weren't petty. Buying a house that will eventually get blown away by a hurricane probably isn't the best way to spend your money. But still, we wanted one desperately. I told myself when I was young that one day I would buy a beach house, and that it would be everyone's, as long as they followed my draconian rules and never stopped thanking me for it. Thus it was that on Wednesday morning, midway through our vacation, Hugh and I contacted a real estate agent named Phyllis, who took us around to look at available properties. On Friday afternoon, we made an offer on an oceanfront cottage not far from the one we were renting, and before sunset, our bid was accepted. I made the announcement at the dinner table and got the reaction I had expected. "Now wait a minute," my father said. "You need to think clearly here." "I already have," I told him. "Okay, then, how old is the roof? How many times has it been replaced in the last 10 years? When can we move in?" Gretchen asked. Lisa wanted to know if she could bring her dogs, and Amy asked what the house was named. "Right now, it's called Fantastic Place," I told her, "but we're going to change it. I used to think the ideal name for a beach house was the Ship Shape. Now, though, I had a better idea. We're going to call it the C-section." My father put down his hamburger. "Oh, no, you're not." "But it's perfect," I argued. "The name's supposed to be beachy, and if it's a pun, all the better." I brought up a cottage we'd seen earlier in the day called Dune Our Thing, and my father winced. "How about naming it Tiffany?" he said. Our silence translated to, "Let's pretend we didn't hear that." He picked his hamburger back up. "I think it's a great idea. The perfect way to pay our respects." "If that's the case, we can name it after Mom," I told him. "Or half after Tiffany and half after Mom. But it's a house, not a tombstone. It wouldn't fit in with the names of the other houses." "Aw, baloney," my father said. "Fitting in. That's not who we are. That's not what we're about." Paul interrupted to nominate the conch sucker. Amy's suggestion had the word semen in it, and Gretchen's was even dirtier. "What's wrong with the name it already has?" Lisa asked. "No, no, no," my father said, forgetting, I think, that this wasn't his decision. A few days later, after the buyer's remorse had kicked in, I'd wonder if I hadn't bought the house as a way of saying, "See, it's just that easy. No hemming and hawing, no asking to look at the septic tank. Rather, you make your family happy and iron out the details later." The cottage we bought is 2 stories tall and was built in 1978. It's on proper stilts and has 2 rear decks, one above the other, overlooking the ocean. It was rented to vacationers until late September, but Phyllis allowed us to drop by and show it to the family the following morning after we checked out of the house we'd been staying in. A place always looks different, worse, most often, after you've made the commitment to buy it. So while the others raced up and down the stairs, claiming their future bedrooms, I held my nose to a vent and caught a whiff of mildew. The sale included the furniture, so I also made an inventory of the Barca loungers and massive TVs I would eventually be getting rid of, along with the shelled pattern bedspreads and cushions with anchors on them. "For our beach house, I want to have a train theme," I announced. "Trains on the curtains, trains on the towels. We're going to go all out." "Oh, brother," my father moaned. We sketched out a plan to return for Thanksgiving, and after saying goodbye to one another, my family splintered into groups and headed off to our respective homes. There'd been a breeze at the beach, but once we left the island, the air grew still. As the heat intensified, so did the general feeling of depression. Throughout the 60s and 70s, the road back to Raleigh took us past Smithfield and a billboard on the outskirts of town that read, "Welcome to Klan Country." This time we took a different route, one my brother recommended. Hugh drove, and my father sat beside him. I slumped down in the back seat next to Amy, and every time I raised my head, I'd see the same soybean field or low-slung cinder-block building we'd seemingly passed 20 minutes earlier. We'd been on the road for a little more than an hour when we stopped at a farmer's market. Inside an open-air pavilion, a woman offered complimentary plates of hummus served with a corn and black bean salad, so we each accepted one and took seats on a bench. 20 years earlier, the most a place like this might have offered was fried okra. Now there was organic coffee and artisanal goat cheese. Above our heads hung a sign that read, Whispering Dove Ranch. And just as I thought that we might be anywhere, I noticed that the music piped through the speakers was Christian, the new kind, which says that Jesus is awesome. Hugh brought my father a plastic cup of water. You okay, Lou? Fine, my father answered. Why do you think she did it? I asked as we stepped back into the sunlight. For that's all any of us were thinking, had been thinking, since we got the news. Mustn't Tiffany have hoped that whatever pills she'd taken wouldn't be strong enough, and that her failed attempt would lead her back into our fold? How could anyone purposefully leave us, us of all people? This is how I thought of it, for though I've often lost faith in myself, I've never lost faith in my family, in my certainty that we are fundamentally better than everyone else. It's an archaic belief, one I haven't seriously reconsidered since my late teens, but still I hold it. Ours is the only club I'd ever wanted to be a member of, so I couldn't imagine quitting. Backing off for a year or two was understandable, but to want out so badly that you'd take your own life? I don't know that it had anything to do with us, my father said. But how could it have not? Doesn't the blood of every suicide splash back on our faces? At the far end of the parking lot was a stand selling reptiles. In giant tanks were two pythons, each as big around as a fire hose. The heat seemed to suit them, and I watched as they raised their heads, testing the screen ceilings. Beside the snakes was a low pen corralling an alligator with its mouth banded shut. It wasn't full grown, but perhaps an adolescent, around 3 feet long and grumpy looking. A girl had stuck her arm through the wire and was stroking the thing's back while it glared, seething. I'd like to buy everything here, just so I could kill it, I said. My father mopped his forehead with a Kleenex. I'm with you, brother. When we were young and would set off for the beach, I'd look out the window at all the landmarks we drove by, the Purina silo on the south side of Raleigh, the Klan billboard, knowing that when we passed them a week later, I'd be miserable. Our vacation over, now there'd be nothing to live for until Christmas. My life is much fuller than it was back then, yet this return felt no different. What time is it? I asked Amy. And instead of saying, who cares, she snapped, you tell me you're the one with the watch on. At the airport a few hours later, I picked sand from my pockets and thought of our final moments at the beach house I'd bought. I was on the front porch with Phyllis, who had just locked the door, and we turned to see the others in the driveway below us. So is that one of your sisters? She asked, pointing to Gretchen. It is, I said, and so are the two women standing on either side of her. Then you've got your brother, she observed. That makes 5. Wow, now that's a big family. I looked at the sun-baked cars we would soon be climbing into, furnaces, every one of them, and said, yes, it certainly is. This is called Little Guy. I was sitting around the house one evening when I suddenly wondered how tall Rock Hudson was. It's not often that I think of him, but I'd recently rewatched the movie Giant, so he was on my mind. One of the many things I'll never understand is why a search on my computer might be different from a search on someone else's. My sister Amy's, for instance. She'll go to Google, type in, what does a 50-year-old woman look like? And summon pictures I can't believe they allow on the internet. Unlocked, where just anyone can see them. I don't mean Playboy shots, but the sort you'd find in Hustler. It's as if she'd asked, what does the inside of a 50-year-old woman look like? I did the same search and got pictures of Meg Ryan and Brooke Shields smiling. I said to Hugh, this computer of mine is so wholesome. I said it again after looking up Rock Hudson. How tall is, I began, and before I could finish, Google interrupted me with, Jesus? You want to know how tall Jesus was? Well, okay, I thought, but it's Rock Hudson I was really curious about. Were Amy to open her laptop and type, how tall is, Google would finish her question with, Tom Hardy's dick? With mine, though, it's Jesus, who they're guessing came in at around 6 feet, which is ridiculous in my opinion. What are the odds that he was both tall and handsome? Is he described that way in the Bible? In some of the early Northern European paintings, Christ looks like you flushed him out from under a bridge. But in Sunday school books and the sorts of pictures they sell at Christian supply stores, he falls somewhere between Kenny Loggins and Jared Leto. Always doe-eyed and, of course, white, with brown, not black hair, usually wavy. And he always has a fantastic body, shown at its best on the cross, which, face it, was practically designed to make a man's stomach and shoulders look good. What would happen, I often wonder, if someone sculpted a morbidly obese Jesus with titties and acne scars and hair on his back. On top of that, he should be short, 5'2" at most. Sacrilege, people would shout. But why? Doing good deeds doesn't make you good looking. Take Jimmy Carter. Habitat for Humanity didn't do a thing for those tombstone-sized teeth of his, or at least I remember his teeth as seeming pretty big. I should Google image them. On Amy's computer. At 5'5", I never give much thought to my height until I do. Whenever I come across a man my size at the airport, say, or in a hotel lobby, I squeak the way a one-year-old does when it spots a fellow baby. It's all I can do not to toddle over and embrace the guy. Whenever I do say something, look, we're the same height. It turns weird. Though I don't know why, don't fellow Porsche drivers acknowledge one another or people walking the same breed of dog? With small straight men, I often get the feeling that they don't want their shortness pointed out, that it's like saying, look, I have a bald spot too. I want to ask the guys my size if, like me, they find themselves being hit up for money a lot. Hugh and I will walk through one city or another, and while he'll advance down the sidewalk uninterrupted, I'll get stopped again and again. Can you give me a dollar, a cigarette, whatever's in that bag you're holding? It's not that I have a particularly friendly face, so I have to assume that my stature has something to do with it, especially when the request becomes a demand. I said, give me a dollar. Would you be talking to me this way if I were taller than you? I want to ask the 10-year-old with his hand out. I know that short, straight men sometimes have it hard when it comes to finding a girlfriend, but I thought that for people like myself, pocket gays, we're sometimes called, it was no hindrance. In retrospect, I guess I wasn't paying much attention. The Washington Post has a regular feature in which they send two people out on a date and then check in to see how it went. Recently, the couple was gay. Both stood more than 6 feet and listed in their deal breakers box, short men. They did not, I notice, exclude white supremacists or machine gun owners. Who wants to date you anyway? I wondered, scowling at the photos. I'm not one of those short men who feels he got shafted. Yes, it's hard to buy things off the rack, but that's what tailors are for. I fit easily into airplane seats. I can blend into crowds when I want to. Added height would be of no more use to me than a square head, so who needs it? I like knowing how tall other people are, though, especially celebrities. That's why I Googled Rock Hudson, who, at 6'7", had every right to appear in Giant. He towered over his co-stars in that picture. But with other actors, it's hard to tell. I once asked someone in the movie business how tall Paul Newman was. This was back when he was still alive and before I had the internet. "Oh," said this woman who'd worked with him on Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, "he's tiny." "What does that mean?" "He's a shrimp," the woman said. "In photos, he seems average enough, but in real life, you practically need a microscope to see him." "So he's like the size of a flu germ?" "Just about," she said. "I'd put him at around 5'9". "I'm 4 inches shorter," I told her. "So what does that make me?" "Well, you know," she said. Before I learned to never, under any circumstances, read anything about myself, I'd occasionally stumble upon an interview I'd given. Then I'd recall the journalist who wrote it and mistakenly wonder what his or her writing was like. In Australia, a few years back, I was surprised when a woman I'd very much enjoyed talking to described me as bonsai-sized. This didn't offend me. Rather, I was taken aback. She might have been an inch or two taller than me, but it's not like I came to her knees or anything. I've been called diminutive as well, and elfin, as if I sleep in a teacup. A few years ago, I opened a paper in Ottawa and saw that the journalist I'd spoken to the day before had described me as, quote, slight and effeminate. Really, I thought. The first adjective seemed fair enough, but the second one threw me. I know I cross my legs a lot, but I don't think my walk is especially ladylike. I don't wave my hands around when I talk or address anyone as Miss Thing. In the end, I decided the word was more about him than it was about me. But isn't it often that way? It's one thing for someone to describe you in print, to go through several drafts, and after careful consideration, choose the adjective Lilliputian over, say, pint-sized. It's another thing when they blurt it out. "You horrible little man," an English woman once said, after I'd written something she didn't like in her book. In 1987, while I was home for Christmas, my sister Tiffany got into a fight with my sister Gretchen. I came in at the very end, just as it was breaking up. And when I asked what was going on, Tiffany said, "Why don't you go back to your room and write some more about being a faggot?" How long has that been in there, I wondered. It's scary, the things that come out when you're mad at someone. A couple years back at a small airport in Wisconsin, a TSA agent ordered me to take off my vest. "I've been wearing this for 3 weeks," I told her. "Every day I've traveled to a different city, and this is the first time I've been asked to remove it." The woman was maybe 10 years older than me, which at the time would have put her in her early 60s. Her dyed hair was cut short and was carefully styled in a way that made me think of chocolate cake frosting. "I want it off now," she barked. "Must be nice to hold such an important position," I wanted to say, as I started undoing the buttons. Then I thought of how snobbish that sounded and was ashamed of myself. Here I was angry, and my first instinct was to attack her job, her class, really. Have I always been this person, I wondered, as I walked through the archway in my stocking feet? What does it mean that my second option, "I'm so glad you're not my grandmother," wasn't much better? I later wondered how this woman might have described me, and realized that all she needed to say was "the jerk in the vest." Actually, in this context, the word "jerk" is unnecessary. As with "the guy in the white boots," I think it's already implied. I mean, really, a vest. What was I thinking? It wasn't the kind that came with the suit, but rather a worker's vest, modeled on one from the 19th century with pockets for all my mule-skinning tools. She also might have described me as the gay guy. While this doesn't bother me, I don't think of it as a cornerstone of what I am. Given all my current options, I think I prefer the little guy. Who wants to waste his time bothering a person like that? So tiny. So inconsequential. A speck. Stepping out. I was at an Italian restaurant in Melbourne, listening as a woman named Leslie talked about her housekeeper, an immigrant to Australia who earlier that day had cleaned the bathroom countertops with a bottle of very expensive acne medication. She's afraid of the vacuum cleaner and can't read or write a word of English, but other than that, she's marvelous. Leslie works for a company that goes into developing countries and trains doctors to remove cataracts. It's incredibly rewarding, she said, as our antipasto plate arrived. These are people who have been blind for years, and suddenly, miraculously, they can see again. She brought up a man who'd been operated on in a remote area.